Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast, where today we talk US equities with a focus on banks, energy and consumer stocks. Our guest is lead manager of the JP Morgan US Equity Income Fund, Claire Hart. And in a moment, we'll hear exactly what she has to say on those subjects. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin.
Hello everyone, welcome to the latest Brewin Podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be talking about US equities, and on that basis, delighted to welcome Claire Hart, the lead manager on the JP Morgan US Equity Income Fund, the fund that's most widely held at Brewin Dolphin. Claire, thanks very much for coming in to speak to us. I think in today's conversation, we really, you know, we speak to you regularly, and so we can talk about different things at different stages. But let's today talk about a few sectors and sectors that most determine the fortunes of this fund, which would be, let's look at the banking sector, the energy sector, and then some of the areas of within the consumer sector. We don't need to talk about technology. Of course, that's not an area rich in income, so we can ignore those sort of FANG issues, which clearly this fund is not going to own. So let's start with the banking sector. Lots of positive things to say about that area, and yet, including what seems to be in the early part of an earnings season, quite a positive one, and yet it's been a bit of an underwhelming story over the past couple of months. Why not remind us of sort of the bull case, and then talk a bit about why it's perhaps disappointed very recently.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time today. I would say, you know, you're right. So financials for us are about, call it 31% of the portfolio. And then the banks are a large part of that. So call it 12, 13% and a large sort of overweight relative to the S&P. So what do we like about the banks? So I'd say there's two parts. There's the fundamental, which is, you know, as the Fed moves rates, this you know, basically boils down to net interest margin expansion and more net interest income from the for the banks. So as the Fed moves rates, banks normally, the regional banks that we have tend to lag the deposits. So it's not a beta of one, so to speak. And so they lag the deposit, the rates they pay on deposits, while they can immediately increase the price that they're charging people for lending. And so this, you know, basically it works really nicely for the banks. So there's that fundamental bit that I think works in their favor. And then from a sort of a top-down perspective, I think the regulatory environment related to banks is easing a bit. And so, you know, financials broadly, banks in particular, have always been well-regulated within the United States, and I wouldn't suggest they shouldn't be. But I do think that some of the rules and regulations we've seen put in place since the financial crisis have been a bit onerous. And what I mean by onerous has been expensive for the banks to put in place, and then also have led to inefficient balance sheets. In our strategy, we like healthy balance sheets, but you can take that too far and have sort of, I think the banks have been forced to sort of sit on what I would call lazy balance sheets because they're overcapitalized. So how does this sort of begin to fix itself, and what are we seeing now that's helpful? So I would say, you know, Randy Quarles coming in under – he's not the Fed chairman, but he's sort of the vice chairman, and he's going to be in charge of overseeing and implementing and overseeing supervision of the banks. And he has come up and said, you know, basically, you know, the Volcker rule, we need to make some changes related to this. I think overall, he has said he wants to revisit some of the rules that are in place since the financial crisis. He's also going to be in charge of overseeing, you know, under his jurisdiction, the annual stress test. And this gets back to the capital point I made related to the banks. So he's going to be in charge of implementing that. And I think, you know, as you know, there's a qualitative and a quantitative element to the stress test. The quantitative can be quite straightforward. The qualitative, by definition, is a little more squishy. And so I think having a regulator sort of at the top of the house that's a little bit more open-minded about implementing things. Again, we're not rolling back, getting rid of these rules, but just, you know, to the extent that they can be loosened a bit and run slightly more efficient balance sheets, I think will be a positive.
Are we I mean, there is, is there sort of much political will across the aisles to support change in the banking sector?
Yes. And so for, as an example of that, I would call out the Crapo bill, which has passed through the Senate and had bipartisan support. And so if you watch stuff that goes on in the state, sometimes we do things without bipartisan support. The Republicans have managed to put through some changes that the Democrats in general would not have supported, but for the votes, they couldn't stop it. So I'd say the Crapo bill actually has passed the Senate and has had some Democratic support. And so it's moved to the House, which it shouldn't necessarily be a problem in the House because of, the bipartisan support in the House tends to lean Republican.
What is the intention of this bill?
So it's many different bits and pieces, but the most significant thing that, you know, from my perspective is that, you know, we talk about the SIFI banks, the SIFI institutions, which are significant financial institutions. You know, coming out of the financial crisis, the regulators took a look at it and said, how many banks out there do we feel could really cause a problem for the U.S. banking system? And let's add some additional capital restraints to them. Let's add additional regulatory mandates to go with those larger institutions. So the beauty of this bill, if it were to pass, is that it increases the floor for the banks. So it takes banks, instead of having $50 billion of assets as sort of being the point at which you pass the threshold and are a SIFI institution, it would move it to $250 billion in assets. So those are obviously very big numbers, but what this means for our portfolio are names like M&T Bank, the Northern Trust, which is obviously a trust bank, BB&T. These are names that would no longer be considered SIFI institutions, and so they would be out from under this additional regulatory scrutiny as not being SIFI institutions. So it means that there's not sort of the extra oversight, and extra oversight basically for the banks runs into, it means more expenses. So not having those additional expenses, having a little bit more freedom to conduct themselves and run their businesses without that additional oversight makes a difference.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's really useful because we have talked about deregulation a lot,
yes.
But it's sort of an overused term. It's nice to see some meat on the bones, if you like,
yes.
In terms of implementation.
I agree.
So what about valuation relative to loan growth? You know, you talk about net interest margins, you know, where are your valuation? Presumably you think it's quite attractive, but what's happening in loan growth?
So valuation is attractive. Again, you made the point that the banks had a bit of a pullback, along with a lot of things, but the banks, kind of had a pullback and haven't recovered as much as the rest of the market in the first quarter. I think, one of the things is we've had good loan growth from the consumer, and the consumer is quite healthy, and we'll touch on that in a bit. But what we'd like to see is better commercial loan growth coming out of the banks. We haven't had that yet. So there's lots of different, I think investors are a bit disappointed.
Consumer
loan growth is still healthy.
Consumer loan growth is sort of falling short of some, lofty expectations?
Corporate loan growth is running a bit short of expectations.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the banks can't really control corporate demand. So I think part of this has been, we've seen some tax law changes. They will be implemented. We kind of have the numbers. They will be implemented over the course of the year. I think when CFOs really have those tax numbers run in front of them and know how much money they might save under the new regime, I think it's going to incent increase in M&A and increase in investment. And even just talking anecdotally with companies, when we talk to them and say, how will you use this tax money? One of the ways people talk about is pulling forward CapEx plans they already had. So to the extent you're pulling forward CapEx plans you already had, yes, part of that will be, paid for with lower tax rates, but they're not going to just spend the 1 year tax savings, so to speak. I mean, the efficient way to do this is you might use some debt if it's cheaper in the market. And so I think that's where banks can start to generate some better loan growth and bring that service to institutions and offer them, lending.
Okay, well, one of the areas I think I understand is a hope for increased CapEx plans is sort of the energy sector not least because of the recovery in the oil price. And I know the sector is a very important one to this fund. Not necessarily have to sort of deal with that question, but, what is the broad comment about the prospects for the sector, given we've seen such a sharp oil price recovery?
So I think from a very high level, the names that we have in the portfolio, the share prices have not kept pace with the sharp rise in the oil price that you have spoken about. I mean, that's just it from a bottom line perspective. So we do think there's greater upside in the names. Again, if if we're trading at $80 oil and, you know, you get back to the point where stocks are discounting $80 oil, you would start to think about stocks being overvalued. But even at the current level, which is not 80, it's much lower than that, the stocks are still not fully discounting that. And so there's an element where if the stocks continue to grind higher and they catch up to and start to discount the current oil rate price, we would consider moving money out potentially, but we're not there yet. And I would say of our names, we, you know, Oxy is one name in particular that has quite a bit of exposure to the Permian and to shale. And I think that's a name that I would, they haven't disappointed from an operating or fundamental perspective. I'm disappointed that the share price hasn't really kept up and hasn't returned what I thought they could do. And I think part of it is they're much more conservative about how they talk about their Permian wells and the actual results that they're having, as opposed to extrapolating results where some of their more promotional peers do. So for me, for Oxy, I feel confident it's a when story, not an if story, meaning I think there's value there, and they do have the acreage in the Permian, and they're working it. We're just going to have to wait and see the results to come out and wait for the market to actually see the results before I think we get rewarded in that name.
Are you, I mean, we have seen this recovery in the oil price. I wonder whether, you know, it wasn't long ago, clearly, that, you know, many energy businesses were, you know, frightened for their lives, but,
yes.
You know, perhaps these things are quickly forgotten. Are you starting to see evidence of any sort of inappropriate or excessive behaviours from management or not?
I would know. I would say, you know, every once in a while, again, when especially when it comes to Permian, you can see aggressive behaviour in terms of people buying acreage because they're playing catch up. But I would say, you know, you're right. When oil was at $30, it really was a moment where a lot of management teams had to stop and take a pause. The upside is that I think it really forced them to prioritize their projects. It forced some capital discipline on the sector as a whole. So we fast forward to today, and I don't see inappropriate behavior. You know, I see that companies are still thinking about, you know, selling assets, culling their investments, really thinking conservatively around how they're going to make investments for the future. So I don't see bad behavior creeping back. Even though oil prices recovered off the bottom, I don't see it creeping back.
Okay, so two sectors there where there is pretty decent fundamentals and also some reasonable attraction in terms of price you're paying. As we move on to the final sector, I guess, consumer, I mean, can split a few ways. And I know you have a very sort of positive view on the consumer, but clearly the valuation story not so compelling. But, you know, perhaps sort of lay out the high-level reasons why you are positive on the consumer and then how that's being reflected in portfolios.
So I would say, you know, from the very high level, if you look at, you know, we start with, you know, are people working? And so our headline unemployment is running at about 4%, and that's a very healthy unemployment rate. And I would say what's important to me is when you actually look at the numbers behind that 4%, you will see that people at different levels of education are actually, you know, you're really starting to see a decrease in all the different buckets. So for people that have a college or greater level of education, their, you know, as of February, their unemployment rate was 2.3%, which is quite low. But at the worst of it, sort of coming out of the financial crisis, their unemployment rate only ever got to call it 4 or 4.2%. So, you know, the fact that more people in that bucket are working, you know, I'd say that bucket never really had it that hard. The bucket I was, the granularity really matters where you get to high school and no college level degrees, or people who have less than high school degree. Their unemployment level was quite high, and we are seeing those levels really come in too. So yes, the headline level at call it 4% is low and healthy, but what's important to me is that it's broad participation. So we don't have a bucket in there that's hanging out at 16% and that's not included. So we're seeing broad participation. So I think that's really important because every level, you know, sort of every education level and every earnings level within the economy generates spending power in a different place, a different stock, a different place in consumer staples or discretionary, and that's how it connects to the market. But before you get to that market piece of it, all, you know, the consumer, broadly speaking, is almost 70% of our GDP. So we really need all the consumers to be healthy, and I think we're definitely squarely kind of in that camp. But if you look at things like debt service ratios, those are still healthy, so people are not sort of over their skis in terms of their balance sheets, their personal balance sheets, in terms of how much debt that they have to service. Obviously, rates are low, and they're going higher, so that's why at this point in the cycle, you really need debt service levels to be low so that consumers can stomach increases in rates as they are to come. So I think from that perspective, we're well positioned as well. I think one of the ways is you can connect this to the portfolio in particular are things like housing starts. Housing starts are kind of back to what you think is a long-term average level, but we're running below average for so long. There's still a bit of pent-up demand. And people have money. And so for something like a Home Depot, that makes a difference because consumers continue to spend on their homes. That is a category that continues to grow. So to the extent that you actually have earnings power, people are working and sentiment is healthy, that shows up in Home Depot's registers, basically. So that is one example of a place where the strong consumer and some of these turns and some of these cyclical areas in the market connect to the portfolio.
Okay. And then the staple areas, yeah, which may be a richer source of income. I'm not quite sure where the sector yield is relative one to the other, but certainly some yield around,
yep,
in consumer staples. Is that... Are you finding much opportunity there, or are you trading with a bit more caution?
So I would say the staples generally has more yield. Optically, it looks like it has a higher yield and more names that have higher yields in it. The issue for me really is, for as much as I'm happy with the consumer and happy that they're healthy, I don't see names within the consumer, many names within the consumer staple sector where you can kind of implement that. And that really gets around the idea of sort of the valuations, I think, are extended for consumer staple names. And even separate of the valuations, the fundamentals that are in play right now in consumer staples are rather unique. And so we have our exposure to the sector is basically tobacco and beverages for the most part, both beer and soft drinks. And so beyond that, we don't have a tremendous exposure to packaged foods or household products. And the reason for that is those categories are really not growing, and food is deflationary, right? So you've always got that battle to fight, and food is deflationary. Categories are very few categories other than salty snacks are actually growing. So it's already tough with consumer staples. It's a tough place to be. If you add to that, I call it kind of the four mouths to feed. You know, Walmart's always been a big... I'm going to say distribution point, but the consumer staples have always had to play ball with Walmart because Walmart can move a lot of product and a lot of people shop at Walmart's. So the consumer staples have always had to be relevant to Walmart, and the way you can be relevant to Walmart is help them make money, and that means as a staples company, you give up some of your margin to Walmart. You are paying to help Walmart be successful. But you add, fast forward to today, I think you add to that companies like Aldi and Lidl, Aldi more so, coming into the States, either hard discounters, you know them here in Europe and the UK. Aldi coming into the States is a hard discounter and opening more stores. So they're getting traction, they're opening more stores, and for fun, they're opening them in places like California and Texas, which are Walmart markets. So you have got not just a demanding Walmart, you've got Walmart now that's competing against a hard discounter, and that hard discounter too will go to the staples companies and need, you know, sort of a reason to put their stuff on the shelves. You've got Amazon and Whole Foods. And so, you know, that's, I call it the third mouth to feed, that they're going to be formidable as a partner, so to speak, to move product for these staple companies. The staples companies have to be relevant to them as well. And then the fourth bucket, fourth mouth to feed, are, you know, the grocery stores that are left out there. So, you know, Kroger is an example of a publicly traded company in the States, but also there are, you know, private grocers as well. They also need to, the grocers that are left standing need to fight the other three categories, fight the other three distribution channels or places to shop. So all four of these basically are going to, you know, come back to the staples companies and be like, competition's fierce. You prove to us why you deserve shelf space. You pay for the promotions in store. You pay, you know, basically, I think it's all going to come out of the staples bottom line. So a very healthy consumer, but one that's quickly changing its preference for how and where it shops. You know, the U.S. consumers' interest in buying things like private label foods has actually gone up, right? And so all of that really weighs on these consumer staple companies that are trying to keep their brands relevant and fresh and in front of people, but they have to navigate these four forces in the market that I think are pretty tough.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a fascinating contribution to the debate, certainly on the consumer. I can't let you go without just asking, you know, we've had this valuation reset, if you like, in, yeah, the markets. I mean, does this sort of seem about fair value to you now, or do you think the market looks pretty attractive at these levels?
I think the market is quite attractive. I mean, you can always think of, you know, I think sort of the macro risks, the political risks that are out there, sometimes they ebb, you know, kind of seems to ebb and flow. Right now, it seems to be kind of in the forefront of people's minds globally and certainly in the U.S. market. So I can't say that the market couldn't get cheaper if there was some kind of a geopolitical event. But really, as an investor, I feel like you have to really focus your energy on the things you can control. And since I'm not president and I'm not in charge of France or the U.K., right? I'm not the prime minister. There's only so much I can control. And so, you know, I can't really worry about or spend too much time worrying about relations with North Korea, Putin, going on in Syria. There's obviously very serious things that are concerning. But as an investor, I really have to stay focused on the things that we can quantify and, think about as we're trying to invest. And so I do feel like there's great opportunities in the market. Could it get cheaper for reasons that are not good, happy reasons? It's possible. I would say, you know, by definition, we're trying to invest in better companies with better balance sheets, those companies where they still have brand relevance and they can get people to use their products. And those kinds of companies, they might trade off broadly with the market as a whole, but they recover faster as people start to look at companies that can, you know, sort of weather storms and make it through to the other side.
Okay, Claire, thank you very much for giving us your time. A really insightful update on US equities and particularly those income paying parts of the market. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing #BruinPodcast. But until next time, many thanks for listening.